top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
Spoken, the doomsayer departs.
What? Why don't you get Billy dressed? I'll take him into town with him. Hit the store before it gets all bought out.
How'd you folks hold up in the storm?
Big insurance day.
Sorry to hear that.
What's going on?
It's death.
Something in the mist! Shut the doors! Shut the doors!
The only way we're gonna help ourselves is to seek rescue.
Tie this around your waist?
For four.
It'll let us know you got at least 300 feet.
There's nothing out there. Nothing in the mist.
What if you're wrong?
Then I guess the joke would be on me.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here is a solo, special episode of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, featuring yours truly, Chris, episode 305, the Stephen King adaptation, The Mist. Now, yet another Stephen King adaptation. These tend to run the gamut from the sublime, and that would be The Dead Zone, Stand By Me, Carrie, The Shining, to the ridiculous, the likes of Thinner and Dreamcatcher, and somewhere in between, a film I hold kind of near and dear, the pretty funny Mangler starring Robert Englund, and which features in the book Jeff and I co-authored, Death by Umbrella, the 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons, by virtue of the fact that someone meets their demise through, of all things, a laundry press. So that's a pretty fun one, but there's certainly no shortage of King adaptations, especially now on Netflix, with In the Tall Grass, and the quite underrated, I would say, A Good Marriage, starring Anthony LaPaglia, who viewers will probably remember from the Mike Myers vehicle So I Married an Axe Murderer, where he played his cop buddy in San Francisco. And in A Good Marriage, it's basically about a spouse who finds out that their husband is actually a serial killer, and it's not unlike the Genesee River killer in upstate New York, who had a long-standing relationship with a woman that had kids, I believe, as well, or BTK. So that is not half bad, and I expected it, frankly, to be far worse. Now, The Mist is yet another one of these New England set King features, and there's a little inside joke where the local pharmacy is King's Pharmacy. So again, you have this contained place and sense of place being so integral to the horror genre, and King has scarcely and rarely ventured outside of his main confines. He grew up in Bangor, I believe he went to college there. He's all about that region, and this film is no different. And what you have is a conceit, which is not unlike, I would say, John Carpenter's The Fog, where you have some inclement weather system that comes in and causes some sort of calamity. Like in, the Carpenter vehicle, it's not the weather system per se, but what it's actually hiding. And in the case of The Fog, it's these wonderful reanimated pirates who wreak havoc. And in the case of The Mist, it's inexplicably a collection of very different creatures. So you could throw this one in the category of creature feature. And what struck me about this as the creatures came into play was the similarities to the Irish horror film the quite fun Grabbers, in which a group of pub denizens batten down the hatches and fend off a bunch of tentacled creatures and, you know, fortify themselves with a drink and manage to save themselves and rebuff the creatures' advancements onto their into their town. So similarly, here you have a group of people confined and find themselves barricaded within a grocery store, which I got a kick out of, as in my day job, I'm a business reporter and frequently called upon to cover the grocery sector and new product development and launches and how things are promoted at shelf level. So that, I thought that was quite fun, although my all-time favorite grocery-related horror, I mean, talk about a niche category, would be The Intruder, which is absolutely fantastic and which I urge listeners to check out. Now, The Mist has, first off, just a great cast. So directed and written by Frank Darabont, obviously, who was the mastermind behind Shawshank Redemption and The Green Mile. So it's pretty interesting that he should, I mean, he's just so well-versed in tackling King-related material. This one here features Marcia Gay Harden as a sort of a religious nutjob, Thomas Jane as a doting dad and outsider in this inside-outside dynamic of a town. And that's, again, not uncommon for the likes of a place like Maine, which is a very small and low-population U.S. state that is frequently forgotten about, at the expense of the likes of Florida, Texas, California, New York State, and that kind of thing. And one of the grocery workers is Toby Jones, who is, again, excellent in Frost Nixon and really added a lot of juice to what I thought was the superior Truman Capote vehicle, Infamous, rather than the eponymous Capote biopic, which I thought was a little bit lackluster and obvious. And it's pretty funny, I was watching a trailer for Breakfast at Tiffany's, and I didn't realize that Truman Capote was how it was pronounced in that trailer. But that's a film I've yet to see, but I'm really looking forward to that one. Toby Jones brings all of his, what looks like to be 5'4 height, to a bit of a badass role here, as he's a sharpshooter and good with a pistol. Anyway, inside-outsider dynamics come to play as a group of townsfolk barricade themselves into a grocery store as this mist begins encroaching. And you have this secret, this is very much a 60s kind of monster film, in that the deus ex machina is really the time-honored secret military experiment that's going on and about which many of the townsfolk are speculating and conjecturing as to what it's about. And some of the soldiers find themselves in the grocery store as well, and having to answer a lot of questions about which they're not really familiar, as they're sort of lower ranking grunt types, although there's also a military policeman involved as well. So here, this is the setup, and again, like, it's pretty simple. It's infused with all the good kinds of 60s creature features of motifs that you come to expect, and it's a little bit unique insofar as you have different creatures come to the fore. And again, as the people are reticent about venturing out and escaping, as one of their ranks is split in two by one of these tentacled creatures that reaches in through the loading dock, and there turns into a real cleavage between the two groups of townsfolk, broadly speaking, representing more traditional value holders and kind of Reagan conservative types and more religiously inclined folks with the, and I'm putting this in quotes, maybe more rational, maybe left-wing, as some bloggers have suggested, like Bloody Disgusting and others. And so there is real tension between the two groups as to how to proceed going forward and what it is that these creatures represent and what it is that this mist and this inclement weather really represents. Marcia Gay Harden, as a kind of fire and brimstone preacher, feels obviously it represents end times and Armageddon, and her rhetoric is able to sway a number of the shoppers into thinking they should just I don't know, await end times and just seek a better life in the beyond. Whereas the Thomas Jane character leads the other other group, and you know, standing in contradiction to them, and whether they should bandy together and fight it off to the best of their abilities. Now, while this squabbling is taking place, the glass is basically being subjected to the battering ram of Lovecraftian, almost flying pterodactyl-esque creatures to compound matter. So at first they thought it was just some sort of seaborne tentacled squid type creature, but then they have to deal with these flying demonic hybrid birds, and that adds a lot of interesting fun texture. So what you have is really a setup that's not unlike Night of the Living Dead, except with obviously more more people being able to hunker down. And really, when you think about it, a grocery store is not that half bad a place to have to survive. So when you think about Dawn of the Dead, the other George A. Romero classic in the canonical trilogy, you had a group of people fighting off a horde of zombies and doing so in, of all places, a shopping mall. And hell, why not? You've got everything there at your disposal. You've got potentially a good amount of food that you can chow down on in the food court, and not to mention a bunch of you know, weapons if it's the U.S. and they're a little more lax in this regard with when it comes to gun control. You can pick up probably a few rifles and hold down the fort. The Mist was made into a series that's presently on Netflix, and again, like, to the extent that Stephen King's catalog is pilfered is really quite remarkable. You'd think he was dead. It's pretty funny. There is an endless array of adaptations of his movies, and he's frequently and not involved with the aesthetic choices that directors and writers make. And he obviously famously was at odds with the Shining, and how that came about, and then spearheaded his own sort of reworking of it, which was terrible, which just goes to show what's in an author's head, you know, perhaps can't ever be translated adequately onto the screen. It's I would almost liken the urge to pilfer his catalog with, let's see, deceased musicians. I mean, the likes of Jimi Hendrix or like Tupac, and I, if I'm not mistaken, the former's estate had to take some enterprising, for lack of a better term, music industry types who wanted just to release any note that really Jimi Hendrix played, which really does his legacy a disservice when you put out music that he didn't want to be released and that is probably not very good, to be honest, even though something that's not good by Hendrix is probably pretty good by the standards of, I don't know, Billie Eilish or some garbage like that. But you could throw Prince into that category as well. So it's interesting, again, like the different visions that different principles bring to the work of Stephen King. I mean, Darabont said he wanted to shoot The Mist in black and white, again, to mimic the aforementioned aesthetic choices of Romero and company in Pennsylvania for Night of the Living Dead, and also the work of Ray Harryhausen, obviously. Now, I haven't researched to the extent King feels that this is a true to his vision effort, but and I should also disclose that I did not check out his 1980 novella The Mist, although I hold him in incredibly high esteem, as should all of us. And it should be said that I've been less than enamored with some of the recent rebootings of his famous work from 30, 40 years ago, particularly It, which was thoroughly unnecessary, although well executed, and also Pet Sematary, about which the same can be said. And it's just, it prioritizes, I think, commerce over vision by just doing that. And but by the same token, I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a Gen Z or I always forget what the generation under millennial is, as someone who maybe had not grown up with the iconic It movie and Pet Sematary and needed an updating that's, for lack of a better term, modern. I guess people naturally gravitate towards the cultural offerings that are broadly speaking, newer, and it takes a little bit more effort to track down the originals, and quite often people don't even know that what they're watching is not necessarily the original. So now, reception for this one is very interesting as well. I don't want to spoil it, but there is the, let's say, tension with the divine and with the sacred and the profound that Stephen King no doubt struggles with, and he's famously talked about his Methodist upbringing and his own dealings with fire and brimstone preachers and seeing the hard end of things on the religious side, but still confesses a belief in a higher power and a belief in God theology. Although he kind of biases his characters towards not being so open-minded theologically by having, the Marcia Gay Harden character being such a volatile and powerful force to sacrifice the lead's son and to further her interests as the film degenerates into a kind of Lord of the Flies. And it's particularly prescient right now because of the times, and we're seeing people behave in not the greatest manner as we all deal with the pandemic situation. And there's a quite lengthy discussion with different characters voicing the, I guess, the Hobbesian view of nature, that it's nasty and brutish, and that in a state of nature, a man's tendency is toward cruelty, or the predilection I tend to favor more of a Rousseauian, although not that extreme, social contract side of things, where people are generally good, but just need a little bit of their worst impulses need to be kept in check by, some kind of authority, whether it's a police or militia or something. But sometimes, I mean, you never know. And the pandemic, as we're experiencing it right now, makes me really waver between these two polarities. The ending here, I mean, this is serious business. And to King's credit, it's enough to piss off both sides of the political spectrum, if you want to call it that, although that might be a little bit unfair. But it's very dour and very, very downbeat, but this is this thing that kind of appeals to me, frankly, because as we've discussed previously on the podcast, it's such a commonplace type of denouement that you see in 70s films. I mean, you needn't look further than the most famous, probably, example, which would be Taxi Driver, but there's tons of others that not. That's sort of a proto-horror, more of a urban scum thriller type, but there's lots of others that have really downbeat, I mean, really, really downcast endings. And whoa, this movie is worth seeing just for that alone, because it's really, really shocking. And it's up there, really, with Night of the Living Dead in that respect. They're both just whiz-bang, incredible endings that really pull things together. So what drags this down somewhat is, again, I think the polarization of the two groups into these warring factions for possibly too long. I mean, one could see how an end times preacher could sway a few people, but ultimately I think the Enlightenment adherents would probably win out, especially when there's such an immediate and devastating foe that they have to contend with. Now, that's certainly a debit. I guess this is the point in the podcast where I should talk about what I've learned from The Mist. It's a bit difficult here without having Jeff as foil to give me the hand signal to wrap things up. But anyway, earlier on in this podcast, I mentioned the Sam Raimi-produced Intruder from 1989 as my favorite all-time supermarket horror. But I guess I'd be remiss in not pointing out that Army of Darkness has a great supermarket scene as well. Shaun of the Dead, if memory serves, has a fun one in there too. Dread Central has a fulsome list of supermarket-related horror movies, obviously, as there's a listicle for seemingly everything these days, it seems. So The Mist, getting back to that, borrows elements from Alien, in particular the cocooning of victims and, for lack of a better phrase, bodily evictions, as the newly hatched creatures gruesomely emerge from emerge from their host. You could also throw in Luigi Cozzi's goblin-scored alien knockoff Contamination, which both Jeff and I find extremely hilarious and hold dear to our hearts. A quick plug for listeners interested in checking out our Contamination podcast. We're both obviously huge fans of Italian horror, particularly when it's knocking off American horrors. Andre Brouwer, with whom viewers of Brooklyn Nine-Nine will be eminently familiar, is terrific as the protagonist's neighbor, Brent. In a really neat bit of foreshadowing at the beginning of the film, his Mercedes-Benz is crushed by a tree after a big storm, and Brent finds himself stuck in the grocery store with everyone else, all the other townsfolk. And even after being presented with evidence that a half tentacle was lopped off by one of the one of his brethren, he refuses to believe that there are supernatural doings afoot, and he thinks it's all some kind of elaborate hoax or prank, and that he's the butt of some kind of frat-type joke. The Brent character is basically the town's most skeptical skeptic. Skepticism is obviously one of the oldest epistemological positions in philosophy, and Brent's commitment to skepticism in its extreme results in his quick demise. So that's another terrific way Stephen King pits two philosophical traditions against one another. You could say the Enlightenment, 18th century, and the theological, or the God-centered Weltanschauung, or worldview. And King points out that both points of view taken to their extreme are wanting. Another thing I learned was that director Frank Darabont co-wrote A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, one of my all-time favorite horror films, and I think the best Nightmare on Elm Street in the whole series. So kudos for him. He was one of, I think, three or four writers on that film. So that's really impressive. Like, he's obviously a really versatile, talented fellow. Another thing I learned was regarding the Stephen King source material. Darabont says he loved the subversive horror elements of the novel, which, again, as I said earlier, I haven't read, but which I'm definitely going to get onto now because it's such a really cool conceit to have mist enveloping a town and having it be a cover, like a Trojan horse for a bunch of creatures. To give the film a heavier feel, Darabont used almost no music, which is kind of unique. The result is a really quiet film that really enhances its kind of a small aesthetic, and it almost has a bit of a stage production feel to it because it's very, very contained. Even as the apocalyptic monsters bear down on these people, it has a very small feel, and as you can really tell the threshold of going from inside to out, and the liminal aspects of that really well handled. Darabont's been quoted as saying sometimes movie music feels false, and he says that he's always felt that silent can be scarier than loud, and a whisper can be more frightening than a bang, and that he wanted to create a balance, an optimal optimum in the mist. And they kept the music as a result to a minimum for a more verite feel. Now, of course, the opposite can be true too, as I alluded to, a goblin scoring Contamination, and goblin scoring just a slew of those iconic Italian horrors. So the music is almost a character into itself. But if you use one or use the other, be sure to do it as deftly as the mist does here, if you're choosing, I guess, not to do it. So a star rating, which I didn't want to forget about going as we bring the podcast to a close. Luckily, we have a 5-star rating system on the Really Awful Movies podcast because it gives us a bit more flexibility to, laud sort of smaller films that, although flawed, are quite deserving of plaudits in their own right, but can't be maybe measured up against bigger budget or bigger star-powered vehicles. So that this comes into play here perfectly. So this is a combination. This is a small film driven by, nominal star power, but good character actors nonetheless, with the likes of Toby Jones and Brouwer. So I'm going to give this a solid 3 out of 5 and probably position it in the middle of all the Stephen King adaptations, the bulk of which I've not seen as they're just so numerous. But again, it doesn't reach the soaring heights that you get with the likes of Stand By Me or The Shining, for that matter, and the original It. But also it doesn't wallow in the depths occupied by the likes of the threadbare and corny and silly Thinner. So somewhere in between, well worth checking out, and we hope you continue to enjoy the podcast as we bring you more episodes throughout the summer. And a quick plug as we get into action movie season, our latest book is Mine's Bigger Than Yours, The 100 Wackiest Action Movies, and that's out for pre-order right now on Amazon and will be available throughout North America and in store in the UK as well at the end of September. We have a release date of September 28th on that one. And the foreword is written by Brian Trenchard-Smith, who's a buddy of ours and director of Stunt Rock and Strike of the Panther. And his foreword's really funny, and we really appreciate him helping us out with that. So we shall talk to you soon, and I think Jeff will be on board shortly. Enjoy the summer, and take care. Thank you.